Thank you very much for coming. So this talk is about large-scale detection of malware on the web. This is primarily focusing on JavaScript malware. So at Microsoft Research, we work with Bing, the search engine, a lot. And Bing has many goals. Clearly, one of its goals is to improve the quality of search results. Another goal that's known a little bit less is to protect its users from malware. So here's a scenario that I wanted to show to you first to demonstrate this talk. So you go to Bing, you search for something interesting, and you get this page back. If you zoom in a little bit, you'll see the following. So there's, in fact, a warning over here that says, careful, the link to the site is disabled because it might contain malware. So what's going on here? What's going on here is that Bing has visitors that use a variety of browsers, and basically it feels that it has an obligation to its users to not serve malicious links. So to do so, it needs to figure out which websites to blacklist. Now, how does one do that? How does one figure out if a site is malicious or benign? Well, there are several approaches to doing so, and this is my sort of representation of the malware detection landscape, primarily focusing on drive-by malware, drive-by downloads, what's called. So there is one interesting dimension I want to emphasize at first, which is runtime versus static detection. Runtimes means observe malware as it's running in your browser, try to figure out that something is going wrong, stop it. Static means look at your code, primarily JavaScript code, and if the code looks malicious, then stop it from executing. Another dimension that I wanted to emphasize as well is offline versus online detection. Offline means go to a site, visit it, figure out if it's malicious. Online means run it in the browser as the user is doing their sort of daily browsing and do just-in-time detection. Now, within this landscape, I wanted to mention two projects in particular. One of them is the Nuzzle project that goes back 2 years. It was a paper presented at this very conference 2 years ago precisely. And Nuzzle is an offline, primarily offline, runtime malware detector. So how does it work? It basically instruments the browser, it observes allocations that are happening in browser memory, and it looks for heap sprays. Nuzzle is actually very effective. It's helped Bing tremendously. It's able to detect thousands of malware sites every single day, but at the same time, it has a problem, which is the overhead of Nuzzle is actually fairly high, which means that we generally only use it for offline detection. We don't generally push it into the browser for daily use. The project I'm going to talk about today is called Zazzle, so you see a bit of a naming convention here. So 2 years since then, the focus of Zazzle is on performing what's called mostly static malware detection. I'll describe what that means in just a second. The focus of Zazzle is on providing a low overhead detector which has high reach. Basically, we want to find many more malware sites than Nuzzle does. And the secondary goal is to have a detector that's something we can deploy in a browser. And just to restate where we want to be, we really would like to be over there. Ultimately, we want to be able to deploy Zazzle in a running browser, and there are several advantages to doing so if you think about it for a second. So detection is immediate. This is basically just-in-time malware detection, which is great, and it's great in part because there is basically no gap between what the user sees in their browser, in their own browser, and what the server can observe. Because typically there is a gap between the way the server creates blacklist and between what the user sees, and there's a variety of reasons for that being the case. One of them is that there are many pages behind login, login credentials. Another reason is that there are pages on the internet that are impossible for a crawler to see, and so on and so forth. Now, just to restate the goals of Zazzle, this is what we're going to talk about today. So we want to build a low overhead detector that has an extremely low false positive rate. We want this detector to be be primarily static, so that we can find more malware than a typical runtime detector is going to be able to find. But at the same time, we would like it to be suitable for long-term in-browser deployment. Okay. So, well, how does one recognize web malware, or JavaScript malware, I should say? So by now, I've looked at so many samples of JavaScript malware that I can probably basically stare at one for about 3 seconds and tell you whether it's malicious or benign. But I would like to convey some of that intuition to you. So in the next several minutes, what we are going to do is this. We'll look at some representative malware samples. We'll try to sort of together find some commonalities in them. And then we'll see how those commonalities can be used as features for a classifier that we'll develop later. So here's a piece of code that comes from a site out there on the web somewhere. It looks kind of cryptic and somewhat difficult to read, but let me emphasize a few things. Let me highlight a few features over here. So here's what I'd like to highlight, and I'll point them out to you. Hopefully they're big enough to read. So the use of function unescape, the use of array constructors, unescape again, these loops that look surprisingly like heap sprays if you stare at them long enough. Another loop that probably looks like something related to heap spray. Calls to the garbage collector that are quite unusual in JavaScript. Another call to unescape. Another loop. Calls to the garbage collector. The use of the set timeout function in a pretty strange way, and so on and so forth. So this is example number one. Here's another example. Again, a fairly cryptic looking piece of code. A lot of strings over here. We don't quite know what they're doing unless we, again, unless I highlight something for you, which is this. So notice the use of ActiveX objects over here. So in this case, the developer is creating PDF, Adobe PDF Reader ActiveX objects over here in these two cases. Then they're using document.write. They're creating Flash objects over here. They're creating a variable called S-code, which perhaps tells for shellcode. That would be my guess. And on the right-hand side of that assignment, there is quite a lot of code that will they'll proceed to unencode using the unencode function, unescape function, rather, over here. Then ActiveX objects over here as well, and then so on and so forth. Some loops towards the end, the user function delete, and so on. So, okay. Here's another example that actually is a video that I captured on a real-life website. So let's watch it together. This is a site we found in Taiwan. So it looks like a web store. I know that because there's the shopping cart, that would be my guess. There is a phone number you can call. I don't quite know what they're seling here, but it really doesn't matter. What I'd like to be able to do is look under the hood. I'm going to do that next. So I'm going to use these JavaScript or developer tools, what's called. And I'm going to look at the JavaScript that's running behind the scenes here. This file, the first one is quite innocent, but look at the second one. So by now, I hope that you're able to recognize, at least those of you in the front rows, are able to recognize some of the stuff I pointed out to you before. So look at this variable shellcode that they get by unescaping this code, this text over here. You know, arrays, a variable called spray size, no op. You know, the spraying loop, a variable called memory. This particular thing that you might recognize as an exploit for IE6 that goes back to 2007, and so on and so forth. So the point here is that once you've been staring at this stuff for a while, you sort of develop a certain sense of what's benign and what's malicious. And that to us suggests that we should be able to encode that sort of human intuition that you hopefully have now as well in terms of a classifier. So that's roughly our plan. We would like to encode this intuition, which is to say, obfuscated variable names, variables called payload and spray and no op, various kinds of loops, calls to the garbage collector, calls to the delete, using the delete keyword in JavaScript, ActiveX controls and objects, unescape, string from char, the excessive use of eval, and so on and so forth. Okay, so just to restate, the plan is to train a classifier. And how are we going to do that? We're going to start with thousands of both malicious and benign samples. Benign samples are quite easy to get. We can just go down the list of most popular sites on the web and just pick up a lot of benign JavaScript. That's pretty easy. How do we get malicious samples? Well, remember the other project I mentioned, Nuzzle. So Nuzzle allows us to actually find thousands of malicious samples out there on the web, and that's actually exactly what we use to train the Nuzzle classifier. Okay, and the last step is we just want to be able to classify JavaScript code. We want to look at a piece of code and say, is it malicious? And if so, how malicious is it? Well, that plan, unfortunately, is not perfect. And the reason it's not perfect is because of the great deal of obfuscation that happens in today's web. So here's a piece of code that comes from some site. I don't quite remember which one it is anymore, but this is real-life code, a bit of a programmer's joke, if you will. They're using, you know, these O's and L's to sort of look like zeros and ones, and they're generating code at runtime. So if you go through one round of this eval over here at the bottom, this is the code you'll get, and then eventually this will sort of create this code over here, and this will create code that's shown on the right, and eventually the following piece of code will emerge, leading to this. So the last piece of code over here on the slide, sort of this stuff I'm highlighting on the very right, is a very typical heap spring. So the idea here is that the original code, the obfuscated code, might look, well, I don't know. I mean, it is completely, it's virtually impossible to understand because it's highly obfuscated. Yet, it might lead to malicious execution. So here's our revised plan. The goal is to train a classifier to recognize malware, but obfuscated code is probably bad. Well, sounds kind of simple to do. We can probably train a classifier to recognize obfuscation. That's completely doable. But it turns out to be a pretty terrible idea. Why? There's plenty of obfuscated code that is completely benign. Here is a code snippet that comes from a popular library that's used all over the web. This code is highly obfuscated. It's basically self-generating at runtime for various reasons, such as performance. They want to, you know, protect their IP, whatever reasons. Doesn't really matter. Bottom line is that it's not malicious at all. It's benign, yes, it's highly obfuscated. As part of working on Zazzle, we did an in-depth study of obfuscation out there on the web, and here's a graph, a picture that shows, you know, the depths of obfuscation, which is how many levels of eval do you need to go to generate, you know, sort of the last bit of code for a particular website. And so you have white bars that represent benign sites, and then you have black bars that represent malicious sites. And here's out that there is no correlation between malice and the depths of obfuscation. So there are plenty of benign sites, completely benign sites, that in fact use a great deal of obfuscation. So obfuscation is not a good predictor for maliciousness. So here's our other plan, which is here's our improved plan, which is first deobfuscate, which is to say unfold the code. Let the code unfold itself and then proceed to classify. And this is something that actually works pretty well. This is how it is put together. So let's start with a piece of code that looks like that. This is roughly what I showed to you a few slides ago. And then we are going to use the JavaScript runtime in the browser itself to unfold things for us, right? So basically, this code needs to execute. This is what it's there for. So we are going to capture things as they're going into the JavaScript runtime, no matter how many levels of eval or other sort of runtime reflection constructs are being used in JavaScript, we're basically going to capture all of that code and just process it diligently. So this is the first level of eval in this case, and then it will come back and create more pieces of code shown here on the left. That's perfectly fine. Let's go through this process again. There are other calls to eval. Let's go through JavaScript runtime. It will potentially create more code still. Some of that code might be benign, some of that code might be malicious. The point is that we are going to go through this process as many times as it takes to be able to understand and look at the final representation of code to be able to classify it as benign or malicious. So putting it all together, this is roughly how Zazzle training an application works. We start with this pretty sizable set of malicious samples, about 1,000 malicious samples that we collected using Nozzle. We also have a set of about 7,000 benign samples that we collected using other means. On the basis of that, we train a classifier and we also discover the most predictive features. The underlying approach that we use is Bayesian classification, and basically what we discover automatically, fully automatically, are the most discriminating features to use for our Bayesian classifier. So we don't have to pick those by hand. This discovery is done fully automatically on the basis of these two sets over here. And then once we have this classifier, as well as the features and weights, we can either deploy it offline as part of Bing, and I'll show you the results of doing that, or we can alternatively deploy it as part of a browser so that the user, as they're browsing, is in fact protected in real time. Well, focusing a little bit more on detection, how does that work? So here's what's known as an AST, an abstract syntax tree for a piece of JavaScript. This is a very simple piece of JavaScript just here for illustration purposes. But I wanted to emphasize something here, which is we look at code as a hierarchical structure, as a tree, essentially, not just as a piece of text. Okay, and that's quite important. So what we're going to do is we're going to recognize features within that AST. So this variable over here called shellcode will, in fact, match one of our features. Here's another one, which is this substring within a much longer string containing, you know, U, 0, C, O, and so forth, because those are often used for no-op sleds and things like that, will also match a feature. Here's another example over here, which is this variable called memory over here on the right will be matched as a feature. But what's different from the previous two instances is that in this case, the fact that this variable memory is used within a loop will in fact constitute a feature match, which is to say that if memory, the variable, was used outside of a loop, then there would be no feature match. What I wanted to call out is the fact that feature matching is hierarchical. And this is this context sensitivity, what we call it, is what allows us to actually obtain much better levels of precision than we would get otherwise if we weren't paying attention to the context. So at the end of the process, as I mentioned, by using large training sets, we automatically discover features. So here's a list of features and their weights. So for instance, this feature over here is a substring matching feature that has 0C, 0C in its body. And this is the weight, which is roughly what is the probability of that feature contributing to maliciousness. So there's a bunch of really malicious features like over here. But then for instance, if you look at the function unescape, its maliciousness factor, if you will, is only 0.5, which is to say it's used in both benign code as well as malicious code. So it's not a terribly good predictor, but we use it anyway. So at the end of the day, basically, as you do in Bayesian classification, you combine these factors together to obtain the probability of a piece of code shown over here being malicious. This is how our classifier works, whether we use it offline for server-based detection or within the browser online. What I should point out really briefly is that the way we construct our classifier, as shown on this slide, lends itself very, very well to being built into an existing browser. What we can do is we can actually compute these numbers over here that I show on this slide as part of the parse process of the JavaScript itself. And that way, the additional performance penalty of rating a piece of JavaScript as benign and malicious is virtually zero compared to the overall cost of parsing a piece of code. So here's another movie for you. So let's try to do something different. Let's look at a site that's significantly more complicated than the previous malware distribution site we saw out of Taiwan. So here's a site called koji.net. This site masquerades as msn.com. So obviously this is their intention. You can see right from the title, you can see, you know, from this kind of UI that they're trying to mimic over here. It goes back to December 2009, they were probably doing this in New York when it was 37 degrees outside. You know, you can see sort of little signs like that. That's kind of a lot of fun to look at, but really what we're interested in is the code that's running underneath. So under the hood, again, we see this kind of code. There are several code snippets over here that I'm outlining on this slide. And really what I would like to emphasize is that this code is highly obfuscated, which means that, you know, if I were to just look at it by hand, it would be exceedingly difficult to understand whether that code is malicious or benign. And again, let me restate this. The fact that it's obfuscated does not necessarily mean that it's malicious. We cannot just say, oh, you know, I can't understand this code, therefore you must be evil. We don't know. So manually trying to analyze this code is really, really challenging. So eventually, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to give up. And let me move on to the next slide and show how we can do this with Zazzle. So for this demo, I'm just using Zazzle on the server side. This test harness over here is just going to go to this URL that I showed to you before, this koji.net/jdefile.html. So let me run the browser. There you go. You can't really see the browser, but there's nothing really exciting going on there. What's shown over here is IE that's running in the background, fetching resources such as JavaScript, HTML, as well as images. Eventually, I'm going to stop this process and look at what comes out of it. And what comes out of it is really fascinating. I'm going to run some Python scripts. That's not too exciting. But what is interesting is that there are about 20 different code snippets, 23 or 24, I think, that come out of this evaluation process, which is to say that there are 24 code snippets that go through the JavaScript engine as part of executing the site. You go visit that site. This is how many different pieces of code you'll see. Now, I'm going to automatically classify them. This runs the Zazzle classifier over here. And then it says that, you know, this file over here has a maliciousness score of 1, which is it's as malicious as it gets. This is the file that's most malicious. Look at this. There's a variable called scode. That is clearly the shell code over here. There is a browser fingerprinting over here, which is kind of suspicious by itself. There's a call to inject a Java applet that is probably kind of evil. There is a call to the ActiveX object over here. There is other stuff over here. So for instance, there is a spray sequence right here. There are other calls to generate shellcode at runtime and so on and so forth. In other words, this is a piece of code that has all the signs, all the features of malicious code that we've seen before. Now, to drive this point home, if you look at the original version, the unfolded version, if you will, the folded version, I should say, that is obfuscated, it's exceedingly difficult to understand what's going on and then conclude whether it's malicious or benign. In fact, only one of 24 different samples of JavaScript that I'm showing here was malicious. All of the other ones that followed roughly the same execution trajectory were completely benign. So this shows you the advantage and the power of automatic classification that uses the JavaScript engine underneath the hood. So let me just stop for a second here and summarize the contributions of Zazzle. So Zazzle is a highly precise, lightweight, mostly static JavaScript malware detector. Mostly static because we still need to rely on the JavaScript engine to unfold things for us. It's based on our extensive experience of analyzing thousands of real malware sites that we got out of Nuzzle. And to emphasize a couple of things that I covered very briefly, and I'll refer you to the paper to read the details, it's based on AST, abstract syntax tree-based detection, and we built a very fast parallel classifier to be able to sort of manage things at runtime. Our evaluation, well, here are the questions we ask. How many features are needed to have a high-quality classifier? What are the false positives and false positive and false negative rates? How fast is our classification? And finally, what is the reach of the Zazzle detector, which is to say, if we were to run it daily, how many websites, malicious websites, would it find? And to give you a sense of the scale, basically, we've been running Zazzle millions and millions of samples. So far, it's actually been deployed. It's been deployed for several months now, and basically every single day, Zazzle finds thousands of malicious sites out there on the web, which we consider to be, you know, quite successful. Focusing a little bit more on evaluation, there is a trade-off between the number of features we use for classification, which gives us better precision, and the throughput we get from the classifier. And this is roughly what this graph is trying to convey. Luckily for us, there is a sweet spot. About 300 features is actually quite good in terms of precision, but is also quite performant. So this is roughly where we stop. Once we have 300 features, this is our this is a graph that, you know, basically summarizes our performance. Our classifier, the Zazzle classifier, is able to go through a megabyte of code in a second, which we consider to be pretty fast. How do we evaluate the false positives and false negatives? Well, this is how. We started with a set of 10,000 samples, and we found no false positives. Well, so one conclusion is that the false positive rate is zero. This is an attractive conclusion, but it's probably the wrong one, because we looked at a much bigger sample, 1.2, and we actually did find some false positives. Not too many, but some. So we have to pay attention to those. We compared Zazzle in terms of the false positives to a set of 5 different antivirus engines that are commercially available out there. And we concluded that the false positive of Zazzle is as good or better than that of these false positive engines that have been tuned to produce a very low number of false positives, so we're quite happy about that. So the false positive rate is about 1 in 250,000 if you look at these numbers, right? The false negative rate is the other side of the coin, if you will. So the false negative rate for Zazzle is about 9%, under 10%, which is much, much lower than it is for some of these antivirus engines. For some of the antivirus engines, the false negative rate is about 80%. What does it mean? It means that Zazzle, in fact, finds more malware out there than any other detector that we know. I only have a couple of minutes. Let me sort of show, first of all, there is a limitation of Zazzle that I'll readily admit here, which is basically just as any classifier-based tool, you can train against the classifier. If you're a malware author who is determined to avoid Zazzle, you can do so. Another limitation that's actually technically somewhat more interesting is that we see code that looks like this out there on the web. It's a little difficult to read, so let me highlight a couple of things here, which is basically this kind of stuff, which is they're essentially doing fingerprinting on the client side. So they say if your browser is IE6, then follow this path. If your browser is IE7, follow that path. If you have this ActiveX, follow that path. Now, if you are scanning, for instance, using Firefox, then none of these things are going to come up. This is to say that, the efficacy of your scanning is highly browser and environment dependent. And so I wanted to give a plug here for a more recent piece of work called Razzle, again, this crazy naming convention striking, that actually focuses on this environment specificity that I described on this slide. Finally, a call to action. So this is a graph that shows us running Zazzle as part of Bing's malware detection effort for the month of June. So on the X, we have the days in the month of June, and on the Y, we have basically numbers in thousands. I'm not showing the precise numbers, but they're in thousands, which means that basically we have a lot of data that we are sitting on. So if you're a researcher in the audience who is interested in malware detection, especially JavaScript malware detection, come and talk to us. We might be able to share the data. We might be able to make something interesting happen. And finally, please look at our paper. Thank you very much.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. I just have a quick question. You mentioned that you can actually run this on the browser in real time, and I was wondering if it's possible for an attacker to actually overwrite your probability table or the weightage table, and that would basically nullify your classifier, right?
Yes. So yes, it's possible. Basically, it's difficult to obtain any measure of integrity on the client. Once you give out your code, it's both visible and somebody can tamper with it. Basically, it is not impossible. We have to weigh the expediency of detection for the majority of users against the probability of an attacker doing exactly what you described. And so we still feel, generally speaking, that there is some value in making it more expedient and increasing the reach, which means including sites that are behind login, paywalls, and things like that. Rachel?
Are you worried about you talked about the problem of malware authors training against the classifier, but there's also the problem of, as presumably over time you're going to want to retrain, and malware authors trying to permute your false positive rate. Is there anything that you've done to sort of address that?
Yes, this is very much true, and so we do look at things over time. We compare, in fact, our results that we get from Nozzle and Zazzle, and then ask a variety of questions, like why is this site detected by Nozzle but not by Zazzle, and vice versa. We also look at things sort of longitudinally, if you will, and we do retrain our classifier, and in fact, what we see is that Zazzle gives us kind of a preview of coming attractions. Many times we see attackers training their malware. It's not quite functional yet, but we see it anyway, so which means we can actually develop a classifier for that upcoming malware. And that's actually where much of the power of static detection comes from.
Hi, thanks for a very interesting presentation. My question is exactly about that slide. So it shows amount of detections of the malware. Why is such a huge gap on one of the days?
I knew somebody would ask that question, but I didn't plan that. I mean, that was actually... So the point here is that this is real data. This is data that comes from real life. Running things on a very large scale is a highly stochastic process. My guess, and I don't know for sure, is that they might have been migrating data centers. That would be my guess, but I don't know for a fact.
So two quick questions. So yes. The first one. So have you noticed a lot of code reuse among these malicious scripts? In other words, you know, do you think that authors of these scripts kind of reuse code and share code together? And the second question is, so I was wondering, you mentioned on one of your results slides that you used 1.2 million samples. And so I was just wondering, how did you actually, you know, determine the ground truth? Did you actually go through all of those manually to double check the reported results from the classifier?
The first question was about code reuse. So in some sense, malware authors are really great at code reuse. They'll make, you know, excellent software engineers someday. So here's a slide that actually goes back to the summer where one of our interns was looking at samples of real-life data and actually classifying them into buckets by the type of vulnerability that they use. And what this graph over here shows is that, you know, there is a great deal of code reuse. Much of the malware we see in real life is falls into, you know, maybe 4, 5, 6 different large buckets. Of course, there's a long tail. Every once in a while, we'll see something that we haven't seen before. But it's really this code reuse that is the reason behind our classifier, Zazzle, being so effective. There's really not as much variety as you might expect, naively. There's a great deal of code reuse. And the second question, I'm sorry?
Right. The second question was about those 1.2 million.
So it's a bit of a longer discussion, and I'm happy to take it offline, but we had what's called golden sets that we obtained using various means. Whenever we had disagreements, we would examine things by hand. So whenever we had disagreements between the antivirus engine and Zazzle or anything else, we would look at things in more detail. Thank you.
Niels? Hi, Niels Provost, Google. I noticed that you trained your classifiers based on samples that you get from Nozzle, which, as far as I understand, only detect heap sprays. It turns out that the malicious web is actually much larger than that. And so I'm wondering if maybe the fact that you're only finding a certain number of exploits is because Zazzle has not been trained for malicious JavaScript that does not invoke heap sprays.
I'm just looking for a slide that I want to show you, but I don't have that slide handy. The answer is, surprisingly enough, we didn't quite expect that. We thought that that's exactly what we'd find. We'd find only heap sprays, and we'd basically go home after 2 days. The answer is no. We, in fact, find a variety of other types of malware. We find malware that does not use heap sprays. We find some samples of scareware, what's known. We find a lot of broken malware that any runtime detector wouldn't be able to pick up. But this, like I said, you know, like in my response to Rachel, gives us an advanced preview of the malware that's coming down the pipe. So the reach of Zazzle is considerably bigger than just heap sprays. It's a lot more.
You mentioned browser fingerprinting. Is this solely based on the user agent string, or is there any voodoo involved to detect the browser?
Thank you for that question. So let me plug this technical report we have out as of last week. It talks, you know, for 20 pages about browser fingerprinting. Everything you want to know is kind of in there, probably more. There's a variety of means to do browser fingerprinting. Server-side fingerprinting is fairly common. We primarily focus on client-side fingerprinting because there we have a contribution to make. Server-side fingerprinting, there are well-known techniques to sort of deal with that. Really, our focus in this work over here is how to do with JavaScript. And what we do is in the form of multi-execution, in fact, to deal with these environment dependencies that I showed to you on this slide. Thank you.
Great, thank you.